you need to look at everything. You know, you need to look at the whole picture and be smart about this whole picture, because you don't want to be left behind. And I think that's when I said, okay, well, what are the other aspects in my life where I can really try to make these small, and it's marginal gains, right? These little fractions of a percent, but they add up. And when you're at that level and everybody's super fit, it's those little details that are going to make a difference.
Hey, what's up, everybody? It's John here. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Fueling the Pursuit presented by UCAN. The voice you just heard was that of Tim O'Donnell, the fastest American in history at the Kona Ironman World Championships in Hawaii. So how would you guys like to know how to run a sub-8-hour Ironman in Kona? Well, Tim gave us the answer. All you have to do is chase happiness the entire way. At the heart of Tim O'Donnell's success as a pro triathlete is his journey towards perfecting his ability to stay present and his commitment to focus on the details. So many of our fellow runners share an admiration for those who compete in the endurance sport of triathlons, and more specifically at the Ironman distance, because it's a true test of how much one person can truly endure. Our conversation with Tim will leave you in awe, not just because he has accomplished so much as a pro triathlete, but maybe even more so for what he has learned along the way to the top of his sport. There are a lot of lessons throughout this conversation with Tim, so make sure to grab your favorite pen and notebook and get ready to jot down a lesson or two or three that resonate with you. Now, before we get into this episode with Tim, I want to take a moment to introduce UCAN and this podcast to our newest listeners. UCAN is a go-to nutrition product of choice for so many elite athletes. But even UCAN knows that true success is about so much more than what you've put into your body. It's about how you fuel your passion, your motivations, and your mindset. That's why this podcast is going to take you guys inside the minds of Olympians, elite athletes, coaches, and trainers to better understand what drives them to constantly push to achieve new personal bests. We're so excited to have you guys on this journey with us, and we hope that we can give you a little more fuel as you work towards optimizing your own performances, both in sport and in life. Now, on to the episode with Tim.
Today's guest is Tim O'Donnell, world champion long distance triathlete, four-time top American finisher at the Ironman World Championships in Kona, Hawaii, and first American to go sub-8 on the famously difficult course. Tim got started in triathlon at the U.S. Naval Academy, where he won 6 back-to-back Armed Forces Triathlon Championships. In 2009, he transitioned to long course triathlons and found immediate success, winning the world championship that year. He's since gone on to win numerous events around the world and finished 2nd at the Ironman World Championships in 2019. We look forward to learning how Tim approaches his craft and how he's continued to push himself to higher heights. Tim, thank you for being here. It's so great to have you on the podcast.
Oh, thanks, guys. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Yes, thank you so much for taking the time to connect with us today, Tim. I was just mentioning when you were joining us on the recording here, how I would love to learn more about triathlons and the Ironman distance. I've been a fan of it as a distance runner, but in many ways, very intimidated by it because of certain aspects of the event, primarily the swimming. So I'm excited to pick your brain today.
Absolutely.
Well, Tim, real quick, just to level set everything, can you just give us an idea of where you're at right now in terms of, you know, how things are going? Obviously, we're in the middle of a giant pandemic and you've got, I believe, a new baby who's just arrived in your house. So like, how are things for you right now?
You know, it's great. It's been very hectic. Our second child, Finn, was born in January, and that's kind of turned the world upside down a little bit. My wife, Marinda, aka Rennie, is also a triathlete. So she's starting to get back into training now. And we actually got to the start line a couple of weeks ago in Miami at Challenge Miami. So the season's underway. Right now, I took a little step back. Things got a little hectic. We had a pipe burst in our house 8 weeks after Finn was born. So we had new baby, no nanny, trying to train for a race and trying to totally repair our house from destruction and chaos. So we feel like we've gotten through everything now and we're turning around and getting focused back on training and ultimately the Ironman World Championship in October.
Right. Well, this is great because the reality is all the stuff you just described is kind of the stuff that every athlete has to deal with in their own way. Like whatever it is, there's going to be all these things you have to balance and figure out how to train around and how to make the most out of them. And I definitely want to pick your brain about that because you've had a lot of, I don't know, experience dealing with adversity as you try to train for big events and stuff. We'll get to some of that in a little bit.
Yeah, it gets to the point where you're like, oh, more adversity? Oh, great.
Yeah, right. On the plus side, the more you've gone through it, probably the better you have strategies for dealing with it. Like the first time you have the big setback that right before the big race is devastating. And then after it's happened before every race, you start to realize, oh, actually, you know, yeah, like this is just part of it.
Yeah. And when you realize everybody else has to deal with things too, kind of starts to take away from your pile of excuses that you try to use, right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Yeah. I wanted to get this started off with a really simple question, Tim, which is you started as a swimmer, a competitive swimmer, but why Ironman? What drew you to the Ironman?
Oh, I still ask myself that question when I'm on some of those hard training days. Why am I doing this?
Yeah. No,
So I was a distance swimmer growing up, and I'm the youngest of four, and we all swam. And I was by far the worst athlete in the family, hands down. Like, I remember we swam year round on the U.S. swimming club teams. And a lot of times I wouldn't make the cutoff times for the championship meets. So I'd just be tagging along and like bringing in the cooler or the lawn chairs for, you know, my siblings to use at the race. Yeah. And just, but you know, I loved it. I love swimming, and I just kind of was happy to train hard, and they stuck me in the distance lane because if you're not talented, you go to the distance lane and you just grind it out.
Yeah.
And I really, you know, prided myself on working hard, and I turned into an all-state swimmer, went to the United States Naval Academy and was on the varsity swim team there. And it was at the academy that I really fell in love with triathlon. My older brother, Thomas, who was a senior my freshman year at the academy, he kind of brought me in, got me into the sport. And originally I was short course focused. So for those who aren't familiar with triathlon, Ironman, you know, it's really the pinnacle of the sport. It's a 2.4 mile swim, 112 mile bike in a marathon, a 26.2 mile run. Well, the Olympic distance format for triathlon, it's much shorter. It's, you know, it's between an hour and 2 hour races. So it's a sprint or an Olympic, and it's a completely different race. You know, it's less than a mile swim, 40K bike, 10K run, super fast, super dynamic, and it's drafting. So it's more like you'd see at a bike race in the Tour de France. It's a big pack of guys, completely different race. And that's where I started my career. And I was on the national team, went to Olympic trials, but the whole time I was doing this, I knew that I was the workhorse and I should be in long course racing. Mm-hmm. So I was almost just buying time and learning, developing as an athlete and both physically and mentally, and preparing myself to step into that journey. Cause you know, now you see young guys hopping right into Ironman. For me, I'm 40 and I'm racing the best I've ever raced. And I think part of that is because I was patient, took my time, and I kind of built through the steps of the sport. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see some of the younger guys, but yeah, that's how I ended up in Ironman. Oh wait, sorry. Can I tell a quick story?
Yeah, of course.
This is the definitive point where I knew I was going to be an Ironman athlete. So 2008, I got out of the Navy, right? 2009, I meet my now wife, Rini. I had moved to Boulder and I started doing 70.3s. I started doing half Ironmans, but I was still half foot in the door. I wanted to try to make the 2012 Olympic team. I'd really started running well in 09. And, you know, I was in a great position to make that 12 team, but I had a foot in each, you know, kind of half out the door type of situation. And I went and watched, this is 2010. I went and watched Rini win the Ironman World Championship. I just went to watch, and it was this absolutely amazing thing. And then from there, I fly to Korea, South Korea, and I go to the Tongyeong World Cup. And it's this like small little fishing village. And this is when I was still trying to chase the Olympic thing. And there was like 10 people there, and we're in their little fishing port. It smells like, you know, rotten fish. And I'm just thought, what am I doing here? Like, why am I here? I just came from one of the most amazing things I've ever seen, the most amazing sporting event I've ever seen, to this little fishing village. And I finished that race, and that was my last IT race I'd ever done. From that point on, I said, all right, you know, I'm going Ironman. I'm going to go in. And the next year I did my first Ironman, and it's been an amazing career ever since.
I find it fascinating that you had the experience at all the different levels. And I mean, it sounds very deliberate. When you were doing the short course and you're going for the Olympics, at that time, did you kind of strategically think, I'm going to keep preparing myself to move up and move up? Like, you kind of knew that was the path, even though you're sort of temporarily training for the Olympics?
At that point, I had just started to understand that you could make a career out of triathlon. I had always thought I was going to go, you know, hopefully make the Olympics and then go do something else, go to business school or do whatever. And then all of a sudden I realized, hey, this could be a career, not just a sport I do. And I realized that the career aspect of it, particularly for me, was in Ironman racing. Mm-hmm. And I think I really timed it well because some of the guys that waited to after 2012 to try to transition to long course racing, they kind of missed a lot of opportunities with partners and things like that. And I had the chance that, you know, I'd won, been able to win a bunch of long course races and establish myself, get partners. And I really think made that transition at the right time. And it came down to, you got to be fishing in the right pond, right? I knew my skill set was... Here's exactly how I put it. I can make the Olympic team. I felt very confident that I had a shot at making the Olympic team, but I wasn't going to win a gold medal. I wasn't going to win a medal at all. I was going to participate in the Olympics. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know what? I really think I can win the Ironman World Championship or get pretty close. And I decided I'd rather go and try to be really great at that than just, you know, participate. Even though everybody wants to be Olympian, it's an amazing accomplishment. I still wanted to go big with the Ironman.
I love that. I have one more question for you about making that decision sort of, and I don't exactly know the time frame when you did this, but you were in the Navy, right? So you have this secure job. I'm sure there's some opportunities to keep training and being in the Navy and sort of, I don't know, the Navy will work with you if you're at that level, I imagine, as an athlete and stuff to help facilitate your training and stuff. But you decided to leave the Navy and go full time. So can you just talk us through how you made that decision?
Yeah. And that was probably one of the most difficult decisions I've ever made. And you're right. The Navy was amazing at supporting me. So there's actually the Armed Forces Championships in quite a variety of sports. And I had won the Armed Forces National Championship every year since I graduated and became an officer. So I had the support. I was actually, while in the Navy, I was at the Olympic Training Center and I was an ambassador through sport and worked with recruiting and PR. And it was an amazing experience. And I'm so grateful that they really gave me this career I have. But my boss directly above me actually had been a professional triathlete when he was really young. And he's like, Tim, you know, this is at, you know, the end of 08, my time was up. I could get out. And he just said, hey, you know, I was conflicted. You know, I felt like I hadn't really done what I was supposed to do for the Navy. Mm-hmm. And he knew that. And he said, listen, you did what we asked you to do. We signed your papers to do everything that you've done. And do not feel obligated. You know, most likely you're behind your year group. It's going to be really hard to get promoted and you're really good at what you do right now. So go chase that dream. If I were you, I'd be out that door right now. And I really appreciated that kind of guidance and advice. And it just made the transition something that I could really embrace and get behind. But my parents thought I was crazy. I'll tell you that much. Mm. They're like, what? You got a paycheck. You got healthcare. You got, you got all of this. And luckily my older brother's still in the Navy and he's very successful. He's an amazing officer and he's doing the family name proud.
I think you're both doing the family name proud, but that's in your own ways.
I was going to say, come on, Tim. I want to ask you a quick question then. So you're making this commitment, right, to the sport. At that point in your life, Brian has a really good question that I'd like to ask you. So why do you think you excelled at triathlons and specifically the Ironman distance?
Stubbornness, probably.
That's all right.
No. I think a lot of it does come down to mindset. In my opinion, professional triathlon is the sport where pure talent is the least important in terms of physical talent. If you are willing to do the work and you're patient, you can go a long, long way. And, you know, I think all my distance swimming, I think developed a great engine for me. And then I just had to slowly learn how to run and how to ride a bike and become that kind of total athlete. And I'll tell you what, I saw a lot of swimmers come into the sport that never got over the idea that they were a swimmer. You know, they always wanted to see themselves as a swimmer. And I said, you know what? You have a swimming background, but you're a triathlete and you aren't going to use that as an excuse to be first out of the water and then get crushed the rest of the race. You know, like I want to be fighting all day. And I think those are all key components, but just the willingness to do the work and then the mental toughness you need, particularly on race day, are the key kind of contributing factors.
Which of the two, cycling and running, was the hardest for you to, I don't know, I don't want to say master, but to really embrace and get the most out of yourself.
100% running. If you're a swimmer, you were not meant to run. I had to change my body type almost, you know, I had to try to get rid of all your upper body. Swimming's very upper body type of sport. I had to trim down a little bit, try to get down a little race weight, but it just took more time because I think of the three, swimming is the hardest technique wise, I think, to master if you do not have a background in it. And I think, as John, you alluded to earlier, that's why it's such a barrier to entry for a lot of people into the sport, because it's extremely hard to learn how to swim fast as an adult. Cycling is the easiest because it's just, if you're fit, like you just learn how to use those muscles properly and you just push out power. But running, you know, technique wise, obviously, I don't think it's as hard as swimming, but it was really hard for me. It was hard for me to pick up running, and it was hard for me to enjoy running. I remember running 3 or 4 miles and at the beginning and thinking, this is impossible. This is so hard. But that's where I put my energy. I put so much energy into running because I wanted to be a triathlete.
Well, we're going to ask you a little bit about the day-to-day, the type of training that you go through. Could you talk with us a little bit about that, since we're talking about the grind that you had to go through just to get good at running?
Yeah. When I was younger, I mean, I was doing almost 40-hour training weeks, 30 to 40-hour like serious training week. And when the transition in 2009, when I got out of the Navy, I'm like, all right, I really want to become a good runner. And I was running 95-mile run weeks in the early season. But, you know, elite runners are probably running 130, or elite marathon runners, 130 miles a week or something like that.
The crazy ones.
Yeah, the crazy ones.
I mean, yeah, at some point, was it called the law of diminishing returns or something like that? At some point, it stops helping you. So there is a cap even for the guys and gals who just do that. But it's in the 120, 110, 120 range, sometimes 130.
Yeah. That's a lot of miles. I had a friend whose dad was an elite marathon runner back in the day. Those guys were running 200-mile weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we've gotten smarter with our training, right?
Exactly. They didn't know better.
Yeah, exactly. I've definitely learned a lot with training, and I've had different phases in my career where I focus on different things, but now we're pretty dialed in and we're probably 20, 25 hours a week. If I'm going into Kona, maybe a little bit more, but I have a lot more specific work than I've had in the years past with my current coaches. And we just, honestly, we pay attention to the details a lot more now. I'm 40. Mm. I can't just keep adding K repeats on to my set, or I can't just be like, all right, I'm going to push more and more power on the bike. It's like, okay, well, how can I be smarter? How do I be more efficient? And how do I get the most out of myself without just piling work on?
Can I ask about that? Like, the word I always use for this is purposeful, right? Every workout, everything you're doing, there's a purpose to it. And there's a purpose to when you stop too, right? Like, it's the ability to recover and show up tomorrow and be able to do your work is just as important as what you're able to put into today's workout as a basic mentality. And do you think the way you train today is something that it just took time to learn how to do? Or is it literally because you've now surrounded yourself with different coaches, different mentality? It's a different approach to triathlon. Or is it just an evolution of learning how to train?
I think there's parts of all that. But honestly, I think the biggest thing for me was a shift in my mindset. As I mentioned, I was not a great swimmer as a kid. And I worked really, really hard, you know, and I didn't pay attention to technique even when I was swimming. It's something I really regret. If I go in and speak to a swim team, that's one of the things I talk about. Like, hey, focus on the details now, because it's a lot harder to correct when you're older. I always just wanted to do more and more and more yardage. And I had coaches both as a teenager and then in college. I had coaches that were just old school, like, we're going to drill you with more and more, and that's how you're going to get faster. And I took that into my triathlon career 100%. And I used that as a confidence builder for my races. You know, I would say, I'm doing work that nobody else is doing. No one else is tougher than me. And that's why I'm going to win. And then I realized that it's not a sustainable model.
Oh my gosh.
I realized, hey, you know what? You're a great athlete. You are a racer and you're a champion. Do the right work and don't worry about just trying to out-train everybody. Like, train smarter and win the races the right way.
How hard was it to get yourself to do that though? It's one thing to know the right things to do. It's hard to actually do it and get yourself
incredibly hard. Yep.
Unbelievable.
Yep. And it's a little bit of a leap of faith at first, right? Because you lose that confidence and then you're like, I don't know. And then you just say, all right, put it out of your mind and just race and see what happens. And then you surprise yourself.
Yeah.
And once that happens, I think it makes it a lot easier. In all honesty, I kind of almost forced myself to, because the sport was getting faster and it's adapt or die, right? Younger guys, new training methods, more talented, to be honest, more talented athletes coming up now that have kind of had their eye on triathlon for their whole lives, basically. And I was almost forced into that, like kind of you're backed in a corner, you got to make a call, right? It's fight or flight. And I decided to fight, but the right way.
Well, you know, one of the things that I've read about you and is that you've, I don't know if this is your term or somebody else coined it, but I was reading about how you pursued what they called biohacks, like ways to get better, ways to leverage, you know, legal ways to get the most out of yourself, out of your body and stuff. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about your mindset around maximizing, like finding every angle you can to maximize what you're doing.
And one of the examples that came up was like hyperbolic, using something like the hyperbolic chamber.
Hyperbaric chamber. Yep.
I'm sorry. Hyperbaric chamber. Sorry about that.
Hyperbolic chamber is just a really exaggerated one.
Yeah. I know. We'll just cut that out.
No, I want to lead with that on the podcast.
That's hilarious.
But would that be considered a biohack? I mean, finding creative ways to get more out of yourself naturally. Would that be things like that? Would that be even considered a biohack?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm trying to think when I kind of really realized. I think it was probably, this is a few years ago now, but our swim coach in Australia where we train, this guy's amazing, JR. He's as old as the sun and still out there every day coaching because it's just his lifeblood and he's amazing. And he has such attention to detail. And he started, like, he was on me about a couple things with my swim. And I'm like, oh, JR, I've been doing this too long. He's like, I don't care. Like, you're going to do this. Like, if you want to swim with me or whatever. And I actually put some effort into it. And I realized that's when I mentioned earlier, like, I wish I paid attention to technique more as a kid. I realized how hard I was working against myself over my entire career to get better. You know, I was just like head against the wall, just trying to break through. And the couple little things that we did made me more efficient. And, you know, I've been swimming well, not only swimming well or as good, it's just like, okay, well, you're not using as much energy, so you're better off for the rest of the race. But it was kind of at that point. And I had been doing that on my run, but it was at that point when I put a little bit of that in my swim where I realized you need to look at everything. You know, you need to look at the whole picture and be smart about this whole picture because you don't want to be left behind. And I think that's when I said, okay, well, what are the other aspects in my life where I can really try to make these small, and it's marginal gains, right? These little fractions of a percent, but they add up. And when you're at that level and everybody's super fit, it's those little details that are going to make a difference. And I've seen it, particularly on my bike. My bike position is so much better. We pay so much more detail to it. I'm going way faster. My power is actually down a little bit, sets you up in a better position to run well. So it's been really fun. And I'm a bit of an engineer. I'm a bit of a geek. So I love to learn about these new and different ways to try to make performance a part of your whole life.
Can I ask you about this too? Because you had said earlier, one of the ways you generated confidence was by just knowing you had outworked everybody before you showed up, right? Did you get the same effect by kind of knowing that you've combed through every possible aspect of your life, that same amount of confidence?
You know, I don't think I rely on it.
Oh, okay.
But I feel I don't know if it's a confidence, but it's something that puts you at ease. Like, you show how important what you're doing really is and how much you care about it by the effort that you put into it. So when you know that you're checking off those little boxes, you can feel good that you've put yourself in a good position.
You know, I guess if I were to comment on it from having run at such an elite level in the mile or 1500 meters, the thing that comes to mind is at the end of the day, I knew it wasn't going to beat, you know, some of the guys that I was racing against, no matter what I did. I knew that there was a level even above what I was doing. And I'd ran 3 minutes and 52 seconds at the pinnacle of my career. And that's not slow. But there were guys still running faster than me, or at least performing in ways that I couldn't touch. Mm-hmm. So for me, I always thought about it like this, you know, at the end of the day, if I knew I did all the work and I did it as well as I possibly could do it, I knew it was going to run well. But the biggest thing was I could, wherever I finished, I could walk away being satisfied having known that I'd given my best.
Yep.
And I think that's really important. You know, no matter what the result is, that will trump the result if you know for sure that you gave it all you had. Because what else could you do anyway, you know?
Yeah. I mean, if you put together your perfect race and you're honest with yourself, and I think that's what this all comes down to, you have to be dead honest with yourself. But if you are and you know that you've done everything, then you walk away with your head high because that was the best version of yourself that you could put together and you show that to the world. And it is incredibly hard to show yourself to the world. I tell you that.
It is. Let's talk about something real quick because I feel like we're going to miss out on this if we don't do it. Can we talk about your journey to obviously your second place finish at Kona 2019? And, you know, you had said something about you still think you got more in there. That may not have been your best performance. So can you describe that whole experience for us and what that journey was like?
Yeah, obviously it's a culmination of my career, but it felt like just the road to that race was the whole year was just a bumpy, rocky road. And actually, so I'll fast forward again, started 2018. I started working with my current coach, who then was my new coach, Julie Dibbins. And broke my foot at the beginning of the year, had a rocky year, ended up pulling the late season together, had a great Kona, finished fourth. I had my fastest performance in Kona, even though it wasn't my best finish. Started 2009, we're in a great position. Historically, since I think 2004, every male champion has come from the top four from the year before. So I'm like, all right, I'm there, right? Like I'm in the right spot. Well, I crashed my bike in Australia. It was March in our early season training camp. I was in great shape, had a bunch of good, great races lined up, break my ribs, get all messed up, get home. And I'm like forcing it. I'm like, I got to get to the start line. And actually I needed to qualify for Kona too. They changed the rules. And in years past, I would have basically been automatically qualified. And that year, even though I had an amazing performance, I was starting from scratch. So I had all this pressure to get my qualification out of the way. And then I kept getting sick. I wasn't healing properly. And my wife finally just said, hey, stop. Like, just get yourself back on track. Don't worry about a race. When you're ready to race, then you go race. And I said, okay. So I missed Ironman Texas. I missed Ironman Brazil. This time it's like June. I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to do Ironman Boulder, hometown. I had won it 2 years before, but I was not ready. But I just needed to get my qualification done. And physically, I was healed. I just wasn't in the race shape that I would want to be in to really perform in an Ironman. And I go out there, have an amazing swim. Amazing bike by myself off the front all day. No one's within a couple minutes of me. Get on the run, actually get off my bike and immediately can't even stand up. Like, because I was, you know, hometown crowd, I was racing above my fitness level.
Yeah.
I paid the price on that run and I was going backwards, started to walk, started doubting myself. And I gave up on Kona. I said, you know what? You're not going to qualify for Kona. And I had this whole kind of come to Jesus moment where I'm like, it's okay. Yeah. You're fine. You don't need to go to Kona this year. You've wanted to take a year off. You've been doing it since 11.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. I'm like, and then I saw my daughter and I'm like, you know what? Reining her around the run course. I'm like, I'm going to get to the finish line. I don't care what I get. I'm going to get to the finish line and I'm going to give her a hug at the finish line. And she's going to know her dad is not a quitter.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow.
When I did that, all of a sudden I could run again. My legs weren't blown. I'm like, oh, my legs are blown. They weren't blown. I got back on pace and I held off the rest of the field and I finished third, stayed on the podium, got my Kona slot. And it was, it's amazing how when you take the option to quit out of your mind, how it just changes everything, right? I made it so, hey, you know what? Quitting is not an option. So might as well, you know, get to the finish line.
It sounds like to me, you did two things. You took the option of quitting off the table, but you also took the pressure of success off the table, right? Both of those, you took them both away. And then it was just about just do it. Just put whatever effort you have into it and accept the results at this point.
Right. Yeah. You're absolutely right about the pressure thing. And I think that kind of leads into the rest of the lead up to the 19 World Championships. And you just changed kind of, you refocus on why you're out there, right? You know, you're doing it because your family and because of love. And it's not because of some either internalized pressure or external pressure that you need to be something, you know, be a certain result. And it's hard as a professional athlete not to be defined by your results.
Well, and I think, not to cut you off, but everybody has this experience in the race that's not going well, where you start beating yourself up about why it didn't go well, right? Maybe I started too fast. Maybe I didn't prepare enough. Maybe I didn't fuel right. Maybe I didn't do whatever, but you just get into this mental cycle of negative self-talk, and you sometimes have to find something. It sounds like it was your daughter and seeing your wife and your daughter that triggered you to stop that cycle and start a better, more positive one.
Absolutely. Yeah. Cause you can spiral out of control.
Way out of control. Yeah.
It's funny, but the name of this podcast, it's for a reason. It's literally trying to figure out where does the fuel come from when you're in the pursuit of greatness within yourself and in the sport that you're doing or anything you're doing in life. And I immediately am thinking, oh my gosh, like those moments when you get super fired up from thinking of something and all of a sudden you feel, you know, juiced. You feel like I could do something. And all you did was think something that gave you that energy. And then you feel like you lift a truck, right?
Yeah.
So just to point it out, I mean, when we talk about mindset and we talk about the power of it, we're exploring this right now as you're talking about this buildup to Kona in that special moment. Wow. It's beautiful to hear about that for you. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
We put a little pin in this. We're talking about this now. You get your spot. Now you're going to Kona. You've got your spot. Yep. So that's great. Now you get to go, but you have more setbacks. So if you want to continue telling us about how this goes?
Like I say, it's like, adversity, more adversity.
Right.
So we got back on track. I had an amazing race at 70.3 Santa Rosa. Just well-executed race and good numbers. And it showed that I was kind of on the right path. And it was 6 or 7 weeks before Kona. I just finished this amazing run session. And literally the last step of the run, I go down just to look down at my Garmin and stop my Garmin. And as I did that, I just kind of veered off the road and there was like a 3-inch lip from the asphalt to the dirt. And I just rolled my foot and I broke my foot again. So the break in 18, I broke my fifth metatarsal and it turns out it never healed properly. So it was almost just like scar tissue that was holding it together. So I didn't want to freak anybody out. I just quietly went back to my car and then we had swim practice right afterwards. And I went and got a big bag of ice from the gas station and I have a pickup truck and I threw it in the back of the pickup truck and I just went down and sat on it. And I'm in the parking lot at Rally where we swim. And I just text my coach, Julie. I'm like, can you come out to the parking lot? So she came out. She's like, oh no. And I'm like, well, maybe it's just like, it didn't hurt as much as it did the first time. I'm like, maybe it's not broken. She's like, well, you need to go get an x-ray. So, you know, call my doctor, get an x-ray. The x-ray showed okay, but I was still having a lot of pain. So a week later, I go and get an MRI. It was probably like 5 or 6 PM. And the MRI tech, he like looks at it. He's like, oh yeah. He's like, that's super broken. I'm like, wait a minute. You're not supposed to tell me that. Isn't the doctor supposed to tell me that? So I went home and I opened up a bottle of wine, like an amazing bottle of wine. And Izzy, my daughter and Rennie, they were out doing something or whatever. And I just had a bottle of wine by myself. And I said, all right, this is your one night. You get your pity party. And then tomorrow morning, you are going to do whatever you can to best prepare yourself for Kona, you know, regardless of the situation. So these are the cards you're dealt.
Yeah.
You got to play them now as best as you can. It is what it is. So I took that one night to sulk. And then after that, it's like, okay, well, like, what can I do? Well, right now I can't bike or I can't run. I can't push off the wall in the pool, but at least I can pull. I can put a pull buoy in and do open turns. So I started doing that. And then eventually I could ride on the trainer. I couldn't run until I think I ran outside 8 or 9 days before the race was the first run I had done outside.
What?
But I was able to get on the Altergy and I was doing all this unloaded training where I was just working on my neuromuscular system, but I was getting great fitness from my swim bike. And as you guys alluded to earlier, all of a sudden the pressure of being one of the guys from the top four that's going to win, I went to just this position and just this place of happiness and gratitude that I might actually be able to still start this race because I was 100% sure I was not going to start that race.
Yep.
And I realized how much I loved Kona, how much I love the Ironman World Championships and how much I would have missed it if I couldn't be there. So all of a sudden I'm like, yes, this is awesome. I get to be part of this amazing event and let's just go see what we can do.
Can I ask you, when you got started there, I mean, obviously it's a swimming starting line, but you know the best in the world are out there. So what was your goal for the race? You're on the starting line, but how did you think about it from a goal setting standpoint?
Honestly, I said, execute your best race and then roll the dice on the run, you know? And not even roll the dice. Most people would be like, oh, I'm going to go on a kamikaze mission, you know? And I'm like, try to go off the front and like do this like Superman, like,
I get such a big lead.
Oh my God. Yeah. Like he's got a 40 minute lead. I knew that wasn't realistic because that would have put me in an ambulance on the run course. Right. Like, yeah. And so I'm like, okay, well, execute a really amazing race and then see what happens. And I knew I was in great shape. And actually, I was in amazing bike shape because I didn't have to run. Running takes a lot out of you, especially if, you know, you're a triathlete and you don't have that runner physique and the runner efficiency where you're a lot easier on your body. But if you're an old swimmer trying to run fast, it takes a lot of the body. So I knew I was in great ride shape. So I'm like, okay, just get in the front pack of the swim and then stay up front on the bike. And my dream scenario came true. We had a small break in the swim and then there ended up being like five of us on the bike that were off the front and everybody in the group was an amazing cyclist. So I'm like, this is it. I'm like, you may have a broken foot, but you are in your dream scenario. So just don't mess it up. Stay within yourself, stay in the group and then see what happens on the run. And when I hit transition, I got off the bike and hit transition. I felt like super poppy, like super, just the best I've ever felt getting off the bike in Kona. And I was like, oh, like maybe we got something here, you know?
Yeah. I love that because you have a process oriented goal. It's about evaluating yourself based off of the effort that you're going to give and not off of the final result. Cause you know, your expectations are now shifted and then you're just keying off of the environment, right? You're using the cues, whether it's the break or whether it's how you're feeling poppy and stuff to sort of, I don't know, give yourself the permission to go for it, even though, you know, maybe it's unrealistic that you're going to be able to finish it. It's,
right.
Like, don't hold yourself back. Trust the situation that's happening and give yourself every shot you can.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you go on a kamikaze mission or something like that, you are giving yourself an excuse already, right? You're just saying that you're going to fail or because you're allowed to. And oh, it's like, oh, well, Tim had a broken foot. So that he went on a kamikaze mission. Okay, cool. Like, no, just try to execute the race. And if you do piddle out at the end because you have a broken foot, then all right, whatever. But at least you're in the race and you're smart about it.
It seems like a lot of what keeps coming up for me as you're talking and describing these different race scenarios and experiences, you are perfecting in many ways, or at least owning being able to kind of like, quote unquote, stay in the pocket and just, you're just like, I'm just going to be present. I'm just going to go through and execute. And you weren't trying to force the results. And I think that there was moments when you're describing forcing it. And then when you stop forcing it, all of a sudden, you're like, it's almost like taking the brakes off and you really allow yourself to just go, just naturally flow or find that flow for yourself. And the quote that comes to mind when we're describing a lot of that stuff was from Gandhi. He says, strive on without fear of failure or hope of success. Just strive on and let it be what it's going to be, you know? And I added that last part, but not Gandhi.
But a little John, a little sprinkle of John on top of there.
A little John on top of that.
Yeah, just make Gandhi better, John.
We should start calling you John D.
Well, I was trying to add some explanation, but I don't think Gandhi needs an explanation. But so now you're at this point in the run. What are some of the things that's going through your head? Because you're in this amazing position.
I just focused on the process, to be honest, John.
Yeah.
I was running out of transition and I saw on the head, the race clock there. And it was like 5:09:40 or something like that. And I'm like, oh, wow. Like I could break 8 hours in Kona, you know? And then I'm like, well, I have to run in 250 and you haven't done that. And you've done that in other races, but you've never done that in Kona. And then I just said, okay, well, I guess I'll get to work. And I just totally put it out of my mind. And I think that was really important because whenever the points in my racing career where I focused on an outcome and not the process, I've had abysmal days. I've had horrible results. And I actually remember when I first started doing Ironman, I desperately wanted to break 8 hours. It was a focus of a couple of my Ironman events. And I always failed at those. I was too focused on trying to get that as result versus focusing on the process that would give me that result.
Can I ask you one more question about that?
Yeah.
And that is that the time goal obviously kind of was messing you up to be too focused on that. How about inside the race, the idea of competing with another athlete? So you're out there, and I don't know exactly, I looked this up, but I don't know how it was playing out for you when you got off the bike in transition, where Jan was versus where third place was versus, you know, where you're at. But how much are you keying off of those people as a competitor trying to win the race or maintain your place versus it's a long race and I just got to pick a pace that I think I can run and actually run that pace?
Yeah, you know, there's certain points in the race where you have to play the game and you have to respond and you have to put yourself up against another guy. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, it's about being smart and running your race. Mm-hmm. And it took a while for me to learn all that. It took me a long time to really kind of get a hold of all the elements of the Ironman World Championship. And I haven't mastered it by any means, but I've learned a lot. And I remember in my earlier days, I was in a battle. I was running with Andy Railer, and Andy Railer, he should have been an Ironman World Champion. He was probably the greatest guy not to win the race. He barely lost 1 year to Chris McCormick, 3-time champion, and he's been on the podium a billion times. And we were running head to head, and we were flying. Like, I mean, we were moving, and someone yelled out, "Oh, it's the next Iron War," which was Mark Allen, Dave Scott. They ran shoulder to shoulder the whole race. And then I'm like, yeah, this is the Iron War. This is amazing. And then I started thinking about that and not thinking about the process. And I completely crumbled. And Andy went on to, I think he ran into second that year. And I'm like, ah, man, get your head together, right? But now I understand that all the other guys in the race, they are there to make me have the best race I can have. I want to use them. In my mind, they are there for me. They're there to get the best out of me. And 2018, I ran with Braden Curry for 24 miles of the 26 mile run. And I learned so much and I used him to have my best race. And I didn't worry about trying to beat him or anything like that. I just used him and then I made a move and I won that little head to head battle, but you win some, you lose some, I guess.
Yeah.
I wanted to just like kind of maybe one of the last things that we explore just a little bit is the mental side of the 8 hour barrier. You know, I had the blessing or the experience of breaking 4 minutes in the mile, and that's considered a magical barrier in sports. And I dreamed about doing that since the age of 14 and then was able to do it 8 years or so after having that dream. What was that like for you as far as the magic of breaking 8 hours? And would you consider that more of a mental barrier now that you actually did it?
Yeah, I definitely think it was. And you know, I equate it to swimming. You know, when you're a kid, breaking a minute in the 100 freestyle is like that first kind of benchmark thing you want to do. And then, you know, once you do it, it seems easy. And then you're doing it in practice. And but yeah, 8 hours, it's a little different because it's, you know, course to course. And I had broken 8 hours before in other courses. Kona is a lot different. But yeah, I think it was. And not just for me personally, but I think the whole field, right? 2018 was the first time anyone had ever broken 8 in Kona. And then you had two guys do it. And then the next year you had two more guys do it. So all of a sudden, something that seemed impossible is now kind of the benchmark. And all the guys are setting their eyes on that benchmark and they're stepping up, right? The bar gets raised and the competition goes with it.
I want to ask you, because we do need to wrap up fairly soon, but this relates to your last performance and looking at goal setting for the future. Is now Jan ran, well, I think it was 751. I say ran, but he did a 751. I don't know the right term for that. Finished. You broke 8. Your progression from, I want to say 2017 or 2018, you dropped like 18 minutes on your final time to get to 759 now. When you look forward and you see Jan's at 751, what's your thought on closing that gap? Like, how do you think about your next steps? What do you need to do to get to that level?
Number one, I can't break any more feet.
Yes. Okay. Let's start there.
No, I think, you know, conditions change year to year. And I think if you're trying to focus on just being like, well, Jan went 751, you got to go 750 or whatever now. I don't think that's the right way to go. I think it's honestly like, how do I beat Jan? You know, I mean, he's the GOAT. How do you beat him? And sometimes it's about putting pressure on and being in the right place. And you got to take a little more chances. You got to race. You know, I'm a very internal racer and like, I just get in my mind and I just go. At some point you're like, okay, well, you have to take some risks that may leave you walking or passed out on the side of the road. But if you want to win, you got to take some more risks. And yeah, I think just putting pressure on him on the run.
Can I ask you about, I don't mean to cut you off. I apologize.
Oh yeah. No. Yeah. I was just going to say an example, in the Iron War with Mark Allen, Dave Scott in 1989, those guys both dropped like 9 or 10 minutes off their marathon time just because they were running with each other and it was that competition. So strategically, I need to be in a better place. Like I lost 2 minutes on the bike in 2019 that didn't give me that chance to try to run with him, even though I probably would have stayed. Knowing the circumstances in 19, I would not have changed anything. I put myself in a position where if Jan crumbled, I could pick up the pieces, but I wasn't in a position to gamble, I don't think.
That's right.
But that might have to change.
Well, as far as training goes too, do you have any thoughts on your training approach to try to close that gap? Or do you feel like you just keep doing what you're doing and there's no change needed? It's just about progression and continuing the slow build of...
Yes and no. I mean, so on the bike, it's all about, I got to get slippier in the air. You know, it's all about getting aerodynamic and getting narrow and saving energy. And then that obviously pays dividends on the run, setting yourself up better. And then, you know, after that, I think the run training honestly is me just chipping away. And I saw this earlier in my career where my training is ahead of my performances in my race. And I do think there's a lag time.
Yep.
So unfortunately with COVID and everything, it's given me even more lag time to see if my racing is where my training is at.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, Tim, we got to wrap it up. I want to ask you just one last question. And that is that we named this podcast Fueling the Pursuit, and you've pursued success in triathlon for over a decade now, two almost at this point. So what piece of advice would you give to our audience to help fuel their mindset that they need to excel in their lives?
I would say one of the biggest things for me in my career has been being happy and really enjoying what I'm doing and being grateful for the opportunity to do sport. I mean, it's sport, like, you know, how awesome is that I get to do that for a living? And I've always raced my best when I'm happy and I'm full of gratitude. And I think that goes a long way. And then after that, you know, I have a 3-year-old daughter, so I watch a lot of Disney movies. I got to just give you Elsa's advice. Let it go. You know, like, dude, like, just let it go. It's like, show yourself, you know, whatever you do in training, just show yourself. Don't be afraid on race day. You know, I mean, a lot of people are afraid to fail when they've done everything they can.
Yeah.
It hurts to fail if you've done everything you can.
As a father of two daughters, I can tell you that I'm also well-versed in Elsa's philosophy on training.
Elsa's going to write a book, Elsa's Training.
It's going to be titled Let It Go.
Let It Go. Tim, it has been a delight speaking with you. Thank you for joining us and for sharing some of your journey with us. And we wish you the best in this year. I do believe that you said often performance, there's a lag time from training. Yep. So I hope if you've been getting in the good training, I'm looking forward to seeing what you're going to do coming in these next races.
Thanks, Brian. Yeah. And thanks for having me on. It's been an honor and a pleasure.
Yeah, man. Just keep chasing happiness, Tim, and the times will come and the performances will come.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Fueling the Pursuit presented by UCAN. For both athletes and active people, controlling blood sugar is the key to optimizing focus, performance, and recovery. Thankfully, UCAN has developed a patented ingredient to deliver long-lasting energy while stabilizing blood sugar levels. So to properly fuel your pursuit, both with the right nutrition and with the right food for thought, make sure to visit ucan.co/podcast to subscribe to our podcast show, to see our current lineup of upcoming guests, and of course, to learn more about UCAN's amazing products. And please continue to listen to our bonus conversation with Tim about how he uses UCAN to optimize both his training and competition results.
So Tim, how have UCAN products helped you achieve your potential in your training and in your competition?
When it comes to the biggest improvements I've seen with UCAN, the Ironman World Championship is probably my best example. 10 mile, almost every year around 10 miles, I would start to really suffer, fade, you know, definitely fall off pace. And once I brought UCAN in, I was consistent. You know, I ran the best back half and my fastest marathon, but the best back half of my marathon I've ever run in Hawaii. And I think that's where the power of the superstarch has really shown for me in racing. I see it every day in training too. Actually, I do have a good story. We were riding up to Trail Ridge, which is like a 12,000 foot summit. It's 50 miles of climbing from Boulder. And we get up to the top. It's our whole team and Rennie's there, my wife. And she's like eating everything in sight, like potato chips and French fries or whatever hamburger. And I'm just kind of sitting there and she's like, what? She's like, you're not starving? I'm like, no, I had UCAN on the way up.
That's so cool. That steady
energy.
That's fantastic. If someone were to ask you why they should add UCAN to their training routine, what would you say?
I would say if you want a different result, you need a different product. And I mean, honestly, most of the stuff in sports nutrition is the exact same ingredients, like different companies, different marketing, but it's the same simple ingredients. And that's why I really got into UCAN is because I want a different result in Kona. I didn't want to get all wonky and bonk halfway through the marathon. I wanted to perform the whole time. And that's why I tried something different. And that was UCAN. So if you want a different result, you gotta mix up your plan a little bit.
My last question is very simple. It's just, what's your favorite UCAN product?
Well, I do. So, okay. Favorite product is probably the chocolate bars because my daughter loves them too. She like thinks it's candy. So she almost hears the wrapper opening and knows, like, I'll hear her little footsteps come running out and she'll ask for a bite. But my most used product is the plain, for sure, because I just mix it in so much, you know, either with hydrate or, you know, if I am racing, I will mix it with a little high glycemic, or I'm a peanut butter addict, so I'll use that as my protein and I'll put the plain in as my smoothie. So I'd say, yeah, I'm probably consuming the most plain.
Makes sense. Tim, thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Of course, guys.